Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, we've got polygamy, politics, election reform, and much more. And joining me this morning in studio, Tribune Justice reporter Nate Carlisle is here. Nate, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jennifer.
Also with us, columnist Paul Raleigh. Paul, hello there.
Good morning.
And government and politics editor Dan Harry joins us as well. Dan, good morning.
Good morning.
And you are welcome to join us with the stories on your mind this week. What's there to talk about? Lots of things. Put your comments online, sltrib.com. You can tweet. The hashtag is TribTalk or call us live, 801-355-TALK is that number, 801-355-8255. The state of Utah got a win this week in the case challenging the Count My Vote compromise. And Dan, tell us what happened in federal court.
So Judge Nuffer, David Nuffer, decided that thresholds established for signature gathering to get on the primary ballot are constitutional. The Republican Party had argued that because, and some people say it's because of Republican redistricting that this happens, we have districts that are packed with, in some cases, Republicans, some cases, Democrats. Of course, many more packed with Republicans. But in Salt Lake County, for instance, the accusation is there are a lot of legislative districts that are packed. Democrats are packed into certain districts, thereby diluting their voice in other areas. And so anyway, the issue is you have to have a thousand signatures if you're a Republican from registered Republicans to get on the ballot. In some cases in Salt Lake County, some of these districts, that's very difficult. That's like a third or even more of the registered voters in that district. So the Republicans were arguing this is unconstitutional. You should throw this law out.
Two other aspects of the case went before the Utah Supreme Court earlier this week. And full disclosure, my husband serves on the court. He has recused from this case.
But so how are they going to rule, Jennifer?
I cannot say. But maybe you can describe the arguments that the court heard this week, Dan.
Well, one of the arguments and the one that the justices, you know, you try to read tea leaves when they have these oral arguments. You try to figure out what they're going to do. But one of the issues they seemed most unlikely to accept was a Democratic Party challenge that said the Republican Party has decided it will not allow their candidates, or they have said they will not allow their candidates on the ballot if they only gather signatures and don't go through the convention. Therefore, they should be disqualified as a party, and that means they wouldn't have their candidates listed as Republicans on the ballot. Now, for Democrats, that would be a dream come true. It doesn't appear like the justices are going to go along with that. And so, you know, there are several other issues the Supreme Court's looking at. And the kind of the scary thing about this is we are well into our election season. The state conventions, Republican and Democrat, are just about 3 weeks away. And county conventions are going on now. So there's this sort of unsettling of, you know, these court rulings really need to come fast. So we might see a ruling out of the Supreme Court today, in fact, as an expedited decision.
What does all of this mean for voters? Paul Raleigh, I mean, should voters be watching this pretty closely? Or is it pretty much at this point candidates who are very concerned and wringing their hands?
Well, I think it's the candidates. And you know, like Dan said, I mean, here we are getting to the conventions and things are still unsettled. I mean, with Judge Nuffer's ruling, I mean, the Lieutenant Governor's office has been very clear that those who meet the standards for the signature gathering process will be on the ballot, regardless of what the parties say. The Republican Party has been very adamant in fighting this. They're very protective of the caucus convention system, and you know the argument for the Count My Vote petition and the petition gathering in SB 54, which was the compromise and gave two paths to the ballot, was that the caucus convention system is so it becomes exclusive, you know, by choice, because people go to these neighborhood caucuses. They're usually the ones who are very passionate or the ones who know how to organize the best. They end up electing delegates who are on the extremes of the party ideologies, and then you end up getting candidates who are on the extremes. And the party apparatus has been very protective of that, keeping that. And so the argument is that, you know, they want to keep more people out than keep people in so they can maintain control. It's caused a great deal of strife within the Republican Party itself, and you know, now you have these purity tests and these sorts of things for candidates that they supposedly have to go meet with, you know, Republican-appointed committees to vet whether they're true Republicans or not. And one of the questions is if they, you know, swear fidelity to the caucus convention system.
We did have a story, Dan, about that this week. Utah County Republican Party withholding information from candidates unless they did what?
Unless they signed, you know, what some call a purity pledge or a it's I think the official name is a candidate fitness evaluation form. And I looked at the form, and it's fairly detailed. You know, among other things, it said you will uphold principles of morality and integrity and honesty, and you won't do anything to embarrass the party. It also says you swear, if you become the nominee, not to support any non-Republican candidates. And if you do support a non-Republican candidate, it said you will not be allowed to run as a Republican in the next election cycle. And what they were withholding was pretty important information. It was a delegate list. So here the Republican Party has been trying to protect and defend this caucus convention system. And now they're getting in the way. They're inserting the party in between the candidate and the delegates by saying, if you until you sign this, until you meet with our steering committee and get their stamp of approval, we're not going to give you the delegate list. So you can't campaign. And this was happening until just a few days ago. And the Utah County Convention is coming up next Saturday, a week from tomorrow. Mm.
Raleigh, in your column today, you write that there is a twist. There are some personalities that people might not know about associated with this maneuver on Utah County Republicans' part.
Well, the chairman of the Utah County Republican Party is a guy named Craig Frank, who used to be in the legislature several years ago. And he had kind of a colorful, kind of a checkered history in the legislature. He didn't know that he didn't live in his district and had to resign. And then he kept trying to change addresses to get in the right district. And it was right in the middle of after they'd done redistricting and there was going to be a new district. And he'd move into one house and then figure out that he wasn't in the right district. But he has interpreted the bylaws in a way that nobody before has interpreted them. As far as, you know, the bylaws saying that you need to be loyal to the party and that sort of thing. And he's now created these vetting committees and these loyalty oath pledges documents. It's a five-page loyalty oath you're supposed to check off all these boxes on. But he's what I talked about in my column was he's a lobbyist. And so it brings up an interesting question. You know, he's got clients that he lobbies for at the legislature. And here he is using his authority as a Utah County commissioner Utah County Republican chairman to withhold delegate lists or punish legislators. So he goes to the legislature during the session and he's lobbying for his causes, and he's already shown that he will use his authority to punish legislators if he thinks that they're not being loyal enough. Well, how does that play out at the legislature when he wants a Utah County lawmaker to vote for one of his causes, knowing that he later can, like, come up with some excuse to withhold delegate lists from that legislator when that legislator is running for re-election. So I mean, he had one of his causes is he's got this early college, high school, and it didn't pass, but he was pushing a bill at the legislature to basically have his organization be the only organization that has a right to use that term, early college, high school. And it's interesting because the two sponsors of the bill, the House sponsor and the Senate sponsor, are both Utah County legislators who eventually potentially could be subject to his wrath if he, you know, decided that they weren't loyal enough Republicans. So I think that brings up an interesting kind of conflict in this whole thing.
Dan, we did report that a couple of Utah County legislators not particularly happy about the party's decision to withhold this delegate list, right?
Right. Very unhappy. Very upset at Craig Frank. You know, if they get reelected, which is, I think, likely in those two cases, they could mete out their own punishment to Craig Frank as well. He's made, I think, quite a few people unhappy down there.
So between sorry, Paul, go ahead.
I was just going to say it's interesting because the focus of our story earlier in the week, Robert's story, was Deidre Henderson, senator in Utah County. And everything, you know, from all my conversations with legislators and I've talked to a lot of people in that arena a lot, she is an extremely respected and well-liked senator. And she's come in and she's really shown a professionalism. Now, Craig Frank, on the other hand, when he was in the House several years ago, just to give you an example, he ran for assistant minority whip one year in 2006. Majority whip in 2006. He got one vote, presumably his own, and no other votes. So you can kind of contrast, you know, the respect and the reputation that Senator Henderson has compared to what it appeared that Craig Frank had when he was in the House.
Is this an isolated incident in Utah County, or are there other counties that are requiring their candidates to check off boxes and declare their loyalty to the GOP?
You know, Republicans say that's the only one they're aware of. Mm. And so far as we know, that's the only one this year. Yeah, so they're sort of an outlier.
So between the schism within the party, as we see during the Count My Vote litigation, between this action in Utah County, I mean, what does all of this infighting mean for the state Republican Party?
Well, it means that in many cases, we have a two-party state, which is Republicans and Republicans. You know, outside of Salt Lake County, the Republican Party rules. There's one Democratic legislator elected from outside of Salt Lake County. And so that's what happens when you get a party that is that strong and overwhelming, is they start fighting themselves. And that's exactly what's happening.
Stay tuned. We need to take a break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in Salt Lake City throughout the state of Utah on Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
I'm Robin Young. You're a liar. How many times have we heard that in the 2016 campaigns? But historian Jill Lepore says our forefathers did it too.
It's easy to think that it was less nasty then, but actually a lot of the difference really is just with the language. It's sort of more sneaky. The attacks and counterattacks are more sly, and they're a little bit more literary.
Next time, here and now.
Join us this morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
All the best actors know to really succeed, you have to know your character inside out.
It was like a 3D blast of her voice, how she stands, how she treats people, weird sayings she would have. I knew what her seminar was about.
I'm Molly Wood. Actress Melissa McCarthy and director Ben Falcone on their new film, The Boss. Next time on Marketplace from APM.
Join us tonight at 6:30 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce here in studio with Nate Carlisle, Dan Harry, and Paul Raleigh of the Salt Lake Tribune. And if you want to join our conversation about the week's news, you can tweet The hashtag is TribTalk. You can comment online or call us, 801-355-TALK is that number. Another big story that happened this week, polygamist leader Lyle Jeffs will stay behind bars while he awaits trial. And Nate Carlisle, you've been covering this story since the beginning. What's the rationale from the judge?
Well, the rationale is that Lyle Jeffs can't be trusted to return to court or to not tamper with witnesses in the case. That's a vast paraphrase. The judge had a few more specific reasons for that, but he looked at Lyle's history, evading law enforcement a decade ago when his infamous older brother was on the run, and in short, also that Lyle is, according to the government, the one that orchestrated the fraud in the food stamp case. And so the judge just didn't find any conditions which would guarantee Lyle's compliance and return to court. The defense had wanted Lyle to be fitted with an ankle monitor and to be released to a house in Provo that his family or his followers had obtained somehow, and the judge didn't go for that.
Interestingly, during those arguments this week, the prosecutors did not stick to the fraud charges, and they did bring up a lot of this history with Lyle Jeffs, his close association with his brother and past behaviors. What did the defense attorneys, how did they fire back?
Well, they had, you know, an argument point for point on all that stuff about, you know, how old all the allegations of helping Warren Jeffs a decade ago was, and pointed out that he's only on the prison roster in Texas three times, having visited his brother over, what now, 5 years or something like that. And they had a point for point rebuttal. It's interesting in that, we haven't even gotten to the trial, you know, the actual, like, crimes he's accused of here. The fighting for the last 6 weeks has all been about whether Lyle should remain in jail pending trial. And three of his co-defendants had similar arguments, and the same judge let those three defendants out. Those men are out pending trial. So now Lyle Jeffs is the only one of the 11 defendants that's still in jail.
Hmm. You were in the courtroom during arguments this week. So were a lot of FLDS members. Can you describe the scene there?
When I walked into that courtroom at about 7:40 a.m. on Wednesday, I came through the doors, and immediately on my left was what honestly looked like an army company sitting on one half of the courtroom.
Because and if you haven't seen the images, go to sltrib.com, because we've got a great photo gallery.
Yes, look at Al Hartman's photos of those folks going in and out of the courtroom. But they're all kind of dressed alike with, same color toned dresses, and even the men's shirts kind of look alike. So you walk in and really, because they're all kind of uniform, it looked like an occupation force on one half of the courtroom. And they must have got there really early. I don't know if they were trying to avoid cameras or what, but they were there at least a half hour before the proceedings started. Beat most of the reporters there. And
was it a show of support?
Yes. That's how I interpreted it. I mean, over the years, when there's a big court hearing, whether it's a civil or criminal proceeding, certain FLDS will turn out and let the judge know they're paying attention in so many words or actions. And then the hearing starts, and it goes for a while, and then the prosecutors want to introduce some of the evidence seized in the Texas raid in 2008, and Lyle's attorney asked to pause the hearing so the FLDS can exit the courtroom because they're not supposed to be hearing the evidence from Texas. So,
including Lyle Jeffs.
Including, yeah. She asked that security escort Lyle Jeffs out of the courtroom, too. And so all 23 members of the FLDS plus Lyle Jeffs get up and exit the courtroom, and 1 minute later, the hearing resumes, and they discuss this evidence from Texas, and that goes on for about 10 more minutes, and then everyone returns to the courtroom. But it was a surreal scene to pause so literally an entire religion in the courtroom can exit.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that Lyle, of the 11 members indicted on food stamp fraud, he's the only one not out on bail. What are the others doing? Do we know?
Well, I can tell you what they're supposed to be doing, which is not much. They're supposed to be sitting in their respective homes in Hilldale or Colorado City, and in the case of Seth Jeffs, who's another full brother to Warren and Lyle. He's supposed to be sitting at a house in St. George, and all these guys have ankle monitors. Seth Jeffs, though, it's interesting. The judge is permitting him to travel to South Dakota for purposes of water testing because he runs the compound outside of Pringle, South Dakota, and they successfully petitioned the state of South Dakota to let them expand their well, and so he's supposed to be overseeing that water project, and the judge is going to let him go to South Dakota to test the water there, apparently.
Did any of the FLDS in attendance of that hearing talk to the press?
Oh, no. No, none of them did. I don't know everyone that was in that hearing. I know his most senior wife now, Pauline Barlow, was there. One of Lyle's half-sisters, a lady named Mary Musser, was there. And then the others, we assume, are either Lyle's family or supporters.
Trial scheduled to begin end of May. Is it going to stay on time?
All indications are no. There was discussion in the hearing this week that there's terabytes of evidence to go through, and the attorneys are going to need time for that. So I'd be very surprised if that May 31 trial date holds. It's almost certainly going to get postponed.
Another piece from your polygamy beat this week. The University of Utah accepting some contributions from an energy company that is primarily owned by the Kingston family. What's the story?
Well, the Jacob and Isaiah Kingston run Washakie Renewable Energy, which was also raided by federal agents in February. And you've probably seen their ads if you watch any Utah Jazz games or the KJazz channel or go to Jazz games. They're supposed to be making biofuels up at a plant on the Idaho line. And but the feds fined them here a couple years ago for not actually making the fuel, but instead just kind of trading it with other fuel companies, and then they were still claiming a tax credit. So that was in violation of a government program. And then here recently, the various federal agencies raided them, and we got to looking at some of Washakie's political donations. We ran a story about that a few weeks ago, but we also knew that they donated to the University of Utah. So I put a records request into the University of Utah and saw that they've given about $200,000 to scholarship funds, but then also they've contracted with the University Engineering School for research. One of those projects is still being conducted in Belize.
Are contributions vetted by the university? What do they say about a company that's under current federal investigation giving money?
In this case, it doesn't sound like there was any vetting because they knew Jacob Kingston, the Washakie owner. He got all three of his degrees at the U of U, most recently a PhD in, I think it was mechanical engineering. And and the U says it's very common to keep those relationships with graduates, and very common for those even recent graduates to want to donate to the university, either for the obvious reason or it's a way of helping recruit employees later. The students graduate, they're looking for jobs, and they want the employees to have, in this case, Washakie Renewable Energy on their mind. And because of that, it doesn't sound like there was any real vetting of Washakie.
Dan Harry?
As Nate reported before, there wasn't much vetting among politicians either. And after the raid, as Nate reported, the Sean Reyes, Attorney General, his campaign put, what, $40,000?
$50,000
from Washakie into escrow, as I guess to say, okay, well, we're going to wait and see what comes out of this investigation.
I guess the University of Utah isn't giving the money back.
No, the U says, the money's been spent. It was, it's been given to students in the way of scholarships. The research funding has been spent, there's at this point the U would have to dig back into its own pockets if it wanted to return the money.
And there's nothing, I guess, inherently wrong with the U receiving this money. It's just tainted, right?
Well, I'll let others say if it's tainted. I can tell you that I can't find that it broke any laws, or I was looking at policies of the university even. I couldn't find any policies that's violated.
Well, there certainly is a branding issue, too. You mentioned they do a lot of advertising at jazz games, but also the Larry H. Miller theaters.
Oh, yeah,
and
that's right.
And I went to a movie earlier this week, and I noticed that now it's not Washakie, it's United Fuel, which is another name for the same company.
Yeah, it's that's essentially correct. Yes, it's United Fuel, as I understand, is kind of like their distributor for the fuel they manufacture.
Hmm. Interesting story. Speaking of the Utah Jazz, former head coach Jerry Sloan disclosed this week that he is battling Parkinson's disease and a form of dementia. And joining me now on the phone is Kurt Cragthorpe, a Salt Lake Tribune sports columnist who has been following this story. And Kurt, thanks so much for being here. What's the prognosis for Jerry Sloan?
Well, certainly Parkinson's is a disease that is treatable but not curable. So he seems to be in a position of trying to find various ways to attack it and deal with it, but it is a progressive disease. I know this from my brother being diagnosed with it at age 46, and it was a little bit frightening in that sense, but certainly something that people can live with for a long time.
Why did Jerry Sloan come forward now?
Yeah, I think it speaks to his nature in a lot of ways. Now, he did tell only a few people for a certain period of time. That has become apparent in the last few days. But to get it out publicly, he just knew that people were seeing him in jazz games, including me, looking over from the little press platform and just kind of watching him watch the game and interact with people. I knew something was different about him, and I think that he's kind of sensed that people were wondering about him and just wanted to get it out there. It's kind of a Midwestern thing to do, just to acknowledge an issue and attack it.
Clear the air, I suppose. How long have you been noticing he's just a little bit different? When did he say that he first started to experience some symptoms?
Yeah, I think the diagnosis came about 6 months ago, but it's kind of one of those classic things of you start reconstructing your memory as when the official word comes out. And I would say that even for a couple of years, I've noticed this kind of had a vacant look in his eyes sometimes. And now putting it all together, it kind of makes sense. So I would say this, that when people were talking about him coming back to the NBA, maybe finding another head coaching job, there's something about his demeanor suggested to me that he just wouldn't be able to do that, and that has become clear now.
This was such a big story this week, and a lot of fans rallying behind Sloan. What about teammates? What about Coach Snyder? What's the reaction on the floor?
Yeah, I think clearly that, it's almost like what happens when a person dies, and I hate to use that example in this case, but certainly it makes everyone reflect about the great memories we all have of Jerry and working with him, as some of us have done for almost 30 years, and clearly Quinn Snyder respects him a lot, and it's not as if Jerry's not in a position to still consult with the Jazz. Only last month I was in Las Vegas for college basketball tournaments and saw him scouting players both in the West Coast Conference and the Pac-12 tournament. So he's still involved, just kind of not at this level he would hope to be. But Quinn, for example, yesterday spoke very highly of him, and really Gordon Hayward, who was a rookie in what turned out to be Jerry's last year as the Jazz's coach.
Kurt mentioned this is a very Midwestern thing to do, to sort of just put it out there. Nate Carlisle, you're from that neck of the woods. And Jerry Sloan is a vaunted figure in the Midwest.
Yeah, my dad lives in the next town south of McLeansboro, Illinois. I have to cross Jerry Sloan Avenue to get to my dad's house. And I've been down there to visit my dad, and I see people in Utah Jazz caps. And there's people down there that literally grew up with Jerry and grew up with his brothers and his family. I believe he still has family around McLeansboro. The high school gymnasium in McLeansboro is named for Jerry Sloan. Coach Sloan went to college about an hour up the road in Evansville, Indiana. So they were really proud of Jerry Sloan down there. And I wasn't in Illinois this week. I don't know what the exact reaction was, but he does have another community that really cares about him, probably just as much as Utah does, and that is in southern Illinois, which is very rural. I mean, McLeansboro is 2,800 people. I looked it up this week. It's about the same population of Parowan, Utah, for comparison. So imagine if literally a basketball Hall of Famer came from Parowan, Utah, what it would mean to that town. And that's what Jerry Sloan means to McLeansboro, Illinois, and in southern Illinois.
He's a real down-to-earth guy. Your colleague and our colleague, Gordon Monson, wrote about an incident where he was accosted at the airport. Somebody thought that he was a shuttle driver, and he basically said, yeah, I'm not going that way, but I'm happy to give you a ride. I mean, is that your experience with him, Kurt?
Yeah, it really is. I wrote 5 years ago when he stepped down from the Jazz coaching job that Jerry is like Utahns perceive ourselves to be, at least we want to think of ourselves this way, that we're hardworking, humble, down-to-earth, unpretentious. He's just all those things. And he was obviously for a quarter of a century in a job that would have enabled him to not be any of those things if he had chosen to be. But he really stayed true to himself and his roots and the community that he lived and worked with. Lived in for a long, long time.
Jerry Sloan, of course, has a unique place in jazz history, but he is also an NBA icon, right?
Yeah, absolutely. He's in the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame. He was inducted about the same time as John Stockton and Karl Malone, who have statues on the Arena Plaza downtown, and certainly Jerry fits into that category. The Jazz did raise a banner in his honor in the arena 2 years ago with the inscription of 1,223 representing his victories as an NBA head coach, which is a staggering number, obviously. But yeah, he's just so universally respected, I think is the best word that comes to mind. That people really like what he did and how he did it.
You noted in your column, though, even though people talk about him in the past tense, you say that your column was not a eulogy. Why?
Yeah, just that, I mean, it's kind of the reaction whenever you hear a significant news like this, is just kind of make it a career or life retrospective. But clearly, he's in a position where he can and presumably will live for a long time and still contribute to the Jazz. So it's not as if this is the last word we'll be saying about Jerry. But yet at the same time, I did bring up that word in the sense that it does kind of make us all reflect on what he's meant to people individually and to the state collectively.
Kurt Kragthorpe from Salt Lake Tribune Sports page, thanks for your sensitive treatment of the issue and for joining us today.
Glad to do it, Jennifer.
Again, if you want to join us, 801-355-TALK is that number. Speaking of people in the public eye with health issues, a strange incident in January put Salt Lake County's recorder in the spotlight. And Dan Harry, we've been following this story for a while. Tell us a little bit about Gary Ott and the bizarre circumstances that he found himself in Tooele County.
Yeah, so the police ended up finding Gary Ott, and it was close to midnight out on a lonely Tooele County road, and he was just wandering. It was obviously it was in January, so it was very cold.
And he 19 degrees.
Yeah, and he wasn't dressed for it. I don't know if he had even a light jacket on, but he was certainly not dressed for that weather, and he was just wandering. And when the police, you know, saw this guy wandering, they stopped and started talking to him, and he was clearly incoherent. he started talking about being with his people and his vegetables, and so they got him into the car, and they quizzed him for a while, and then they took him into the hospital to get checked out, and I guess he was determined that he had hypothermia. But it just kind of brought to a head what people around the county have been noticing for some months, which is that there seems to be something off there, that he's not fully engaged. Kurt talked about how he'd look over from the press bench and notice something different about Jerry Sloan, and I think that's what's happened at the county.
Now, Ott says he's fine.
Well,
his two top deputies say that he's fine, too.
He says it mostly through his deputies. He has talked to the press a couple of times. One of them was with Mike Grell, our Salt Lake County reporter, but his two lieutenants were right there with him. And as I talked to Mike about this, they were doing most of the talking. Gary did respond to some questions, but I asked, so what was your view of his demeanor? And he said he was kind of in over his head. He could respond to simple questions, but he wasn't fully in control of the situation. So he runs, a significant office in Salt Lake County. He's an elected official. And this has presented a real dilemma because he's an independently elected official. The county mayor, the county council, he does not answer to them. He answers to them for budget matters. They approve the budget for his office. But he's an elected official, and so legally speaking, they don't really have a leg to stand on to do much about this.
Well, I suppose the one thing they can do, and which they are doing, the county council decided this week they're going to audit, audit of this office to make sure it's functioning.
Right. They're going to do a performance audit. And I watched your conversation with Julie Dole yesterday, and I noted that she was saying, we have audits all
the
time.
She's the chief deputy.
She's the chief deputy and sort of the chief now spokesman for Gary Ott as well. And she said, this happens all the time. It's not unusual. That's not really true. This performance audit, it was specifically authorized to try to address some of these questions of how that office is being run and if there are problems that need to be addressed. Now, I've been thinking about this. So if the audit comes back and says, this isn't working out very well because he's not fully in control, I don't know that there's still a lot the county council or the mayor can do about this.
Raleigh, are county officials right to put the auditors on to this office?
Well, yeah, I think they have a right to do that. I just want to say that, there is some criticism that people close to Gary Ott, particularly people who have an interest in keeping him in office, knew about his condition when he ran for re-election in 2014. And he didn't, and so he was kind of protected. They kept him out of the public eye. He had many debates or joint appearances scheduled with the Democratic candidate Mary Bishop, and he never showed up. He would always have a surrogate. It would either be usually Julie Dole or Carmen Simone in his office, and they just kept him out of the public eye. The criticism now is that they kind of deceived the public because they knew that he had this kind of condition then, but they wanted to get him reelected. Now,
and he's in office under the current term for 6 years.
Right. And here's the other thing is, people have questioned whether he should resign and that sort of thing. And Julie Dole is pretty much running running the office, but keeping him in, he was elected to a 6-year term. If he serves past his half that term, then resigns, it doesn't have to go to a general election. The Republican Party then would. When I mean a general election, I mean an election where you go on the ballot and other parties can be on the ballot. The Republican Party can have their own internal election and replace him with another Republican, presumably Julie Dole, who was a former Salt Lake County Republican chairwoman. But if he resigns before the 3 years is up, then it's a full-fledged election with, you know, the other parties, a Democratic candidate and everything would go on the ballot.
Hmm. Nate.
Well, can you explain to everyone, what does the recorder do? Like, I think it's got something to do with, like, real estate, right? But then what else?
Yeah, property titles, liens, you know, legal documents. I think they record all the plats and, you know, all the property documentation.
And so. Is all that his duties dictated by, like, the state constitution or state statutes, or could the county move some of those services and responsibilities to, like, other departments?
Theoretically, you could, but again, you know, he's an elected official. You could change that law and make it an appointed position, but you know that takes some doing.
The counties, it's interesting because the counties have all these offices that are elected: recorder, treasurer,
surveyor,
clerk. You know, and in the cities, those positions are appointed by the mayor in the city and the city council. So it's an interesting dichotomy, and a lot of people have questioned why the public needs to elect a recorder or an assessor, whether shouldn't that be appointed from a pool of people who have that kind of expertise.
But that you brought up assessor. That's kind of what I was wondering. Like, could you, since the assessor's got some responsibility for keeping track of real estate for tax purposes, could you move, like, some of those recording responsibilities to, say, the assessor?
Well, you could. This is the tradition, you know, and it's you know, under the state law, this is how these people are chosen. And
I mean, the county council do that, or is that dictated in state law?
No, I think it's state law for the counties. Yeah.
Well, I also think there at this point, there's no evidence that the work that they're supposed to be doing isn't getting done. You know, so far there's been no determination that the activities of that office have declined or are not being accomplished. And I think that's what this performance audit is all about.
We need to move on to another story from Salt Lake County. Mike Gorell, our colleague, reporting this week that there's a bit of musical chairs going on between Salt Lake City and Salt Lake County.
Right.
Salt Lake City gets a new mayor,
right,
and the transition, a lot of same faces are trading places.
Salt Lake City gets a new mayor who worked for the Salt Lake County, and now she is what some people have called a brain drain from Salt Lake County. She's brought over Patrick Leary as their chief of staff, so he's sort of running the show in City Hall. She brought in David Litvak, who is the deputy chief of staff, and she's brought over who else?
Brought over April Townsend.
April
briefly.
Townsend. That did not last.
It did not last.
The library deputy director of the library was brought in to do the job of Rick Graham, public services. And, you know, there was a lot of criticism that she let Rick Graham go after 19 years as the director there and, you know, widespread respect throughout the county. She let him go and brought in April Townsend, and I think she lasted less than 3 weeks. And she said,
I think it was less than that.
Yeah. She said, I am pursuing my doctorate, and I didn't realize what a responsibility this was, so I'm going back to my old job. I don't know what that says about Salt Lake County Library, because she's still pursuing her doctorate. Now she's back in that job. It's like, I'd wonder about that a little bit.
So I guess Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams saw some opportunities.
Right. And so now he has hired Rick Graham, who, again, is very well respected. And he's hired Karen Hale, who was the communication director for a long time at Salt Lake City. And so it's been quite an interesting exchange.
We will continue to watch that. Is all that horse trading a good thing, Paul Raleigh?
Yeah, I don't know that it's a bad thing. I mean, you know, these people have experience in government, one way or the other, and have been around for a long time. You know, like bringing Karen Hale over, you're bringing somebody over who's had a lot of experience in public service. Another one that went over to this city, used to be a county employee, was Mike Reberg, who, he got a lot of criticism on the first appointment, so she pulled that back, and now she found another position for him. These are also people who are very, involved in the political process and campaigns and everything else, so that has something to do with it as well.
If you haven't seen the story, check it out, sltrib.com. We're talking about Utah's top stories, and we've got to take another quick break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in Salt Lake City, throughout the state on Utah Public Radio.
Hey, what's up? I'm Shad. Ayad Akbar is the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright behind Disgraced. It's the most produced show in North America today. Next time on Q, we'll discuss the acclaim and criticism that the play reinforces negative stereotypes about Islam. That's coming up on Q from PRI, Public Radio International.
Join us this afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. After Donald Trump's loss in Wisconsin, a convention floor fight for the nomination is looking more likely, and Trump supporters are preparing.
We will disclose the hotels and the room numbers of those delegates who are directly involved in the steal.
We'll have the latest on the presidential campaign. That's next time on Here and Now.
Join us this morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Time for our final segment, the underplayed story of the week. And Nate, do you want to kick us off?
It was on the front page of today's paper, Friday's paper, Salt Lake Tribune, but I'm still going to pick it anyway. It's the story about how most rape kits are still not tested in Utah. This is a really important topic for people, I'll let you read the article, but BYU professors did a study and found that a lot of these kits still are not being tested, despite it's been a couple years now since this has been kind of an uproar. Money's been found to try to get these tested, and it's still only with mixed success at best.
Okay, it is on the front page of this morning's Tribune. Paul Raleigh, what is your pick for the underplayed story?
Well, this didn't occur this week, but it's an underplayed story.
Okay, go for it.
And I think it's significant. And that is that Representative Mike Noel from Kane County, our resident federal government hater, one of the leaders in trying to take back everything from the federal government except for farm subsidies, got a bill passed finally. He tried it last year. It came close, but he got it passed this year. And what it is it makes it easier now for billboard companies to put billboards on the private properties of people who live along scenic byways. Before his bill passed, local governments had the authority to review to see if that was going to obscure the vistas of, these things like Highway 12 from Capitol Reef to Bryce, that are these spectacular drives. And local governments before had the authority to veto a contract between a billboard company and a private property owner along those byways. And this bill has pretty much taken that away from the local government. So now, there's still a review to see if there's if it's going to obstruct the views, but it makes it much more difficult now for local governments to protect what are, these great, vistas and views that bring tourists to their communities, tourism and tourism dollars.
Mm. Dan Harry, very quickly.
I would say that the story about Third South in Salt Lake City, which is called Broadway, being in violation of the international and city fire code. And it was interesting. There was some pushback by the fire department. Bottom line is, that is violating fire code.
If you haven't read that story, check it out. Again, sltrib.com. Dan Harry, Paul Raleigh, Nate Carlisle of the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks, guys, very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, Kirby observes changes in parenting styles.
When you have as many years on you as I do, it's easy to make comparisons between the way you were raised and the way kids are raised today. And I'm not saying that's good or bad. There one is better than the other, but there is a marked difference. You know, parents just letting their kids have their cry.
You see this a lot, where you're in a store and a kid is just screaming bloody murder, and instead of removing that child from that environment, the parents just sort of are hands off. I'm going to keep going with the grocery cart.
Yeah, I got to get my shopping done. He's just going to have his meltdown on his own.
Mm-hmm. That wasn't the way it was back in the day, right?
No, it was not. It certainly wasn't the way it was in my family. You didn't pitch these rages in front of the old man.
You got to read some of this column.
Oh, this ran in 2010, and I wrote, I'm not sure if just letting your kid rage itself out is the latest in parenting skills, or if I'm just getting more sensitive to noise as I get older. What I do remember is that throwing a public tantrum never got me what I wanted when I was a kid. Quite the opposite, in fact. This doesn't mean I never pitched one. I'd be in the middle of a nuclear-level freak, eyes shut, mouth open, uvula sticking out, when a hairy paw would snatch me sideways so fast that it left my lips 2 feet behind me. A billionth of a second later, I'd be halfway to some form of solitary confinement. Even at home, rarely was it my bedroom. I shared it with a brother, and it wasn't really fair to him that he couldn't come in the room just because I was being punished. Usually, I was destined for a closet, a shed, the car, or even the car's trunk. But it could be anything, really. In public, it all depended on space availability.
That's great. That is great.
And we were a military family, so public decorum was important.
Sure.
To my father, and rightly so, I guess, to an extent. But when you get that kind of an environment and a kid who is completely out of control like me, still am to some degree, you got to do something. They didn't have the meds back then to take care of me, so you haul me off where I'm not a danger to the public.
You mentioned later in the column that people would be like, oh, if that happened, they would call the cops. But you point out, your father was a cop.
Yeah, he was. In addition to being in the military, he was a criminal investigator, and he had some experience handling difficult people. When I look back, I don't consider my father abusive. I didn't. I don't have that sense about it. But there are certain things that he just wasn't going to take.
Screaming in Walmart. Not one of them.
Screaming in Walmart or pitching a fit in a restaurant or whatever. No, you didn't get away with that.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can find all the Kirby archives at sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW, UPR, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Save the date, Thursday, April 28th at Trolley Square. Tribune is bringing you a Pulitzer book party celebrating Pulitzer Prize-winning fiction. So hope you can join us. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Have a great weekend.